So I want to welcome everyone here. I'm Stephen Hamburg, the Chief Scientist at EDF, and it's a real pleasure to have you join us today. And it's my pleasure to have Dr. Stephen Pakala from Princeton University and a member of the EDF Board of Trustees joining me. What we'd like to do tonight is that we'll speak for a little bit of time, maybe 10, 15 minutes, sort of to tee up sort of how we're thinking about climate change, the challenges that we see, and the opportunities. And then we really want to make this a conversation. So we're going to open it up to your questions. I know, having met some of you, we've got a lot of expertise in the audience in addition to up here. And so we really do hope that we can have a great conversation and we can all learn from that and benefit. As we think about climate change, I'm always struck by my own experience and the fact that when I first learned about climate change in 1975, and Mike and I were just talking about it earlier from the then EDF trustee George Woodwell, I was still an undergrad and I was introduced to the issue. And I started working on problems related to it not that long thereafter as a graduate student. And looking at, I work on forests and thinking about climate change impacts into the future. And we talked about it. I started looking at the models, thinking about it, and really thought about, okay, this is something off in the distance. It's something that, yeah, we got to think about. And I made it some sort of mental projections on what was the forest that I looked at in central New Hampshire and what were those impacts going to be. And I moved on, and I actually published my first paper on climate change now 31 years ago. And I'd like to say the impact of that paper was very dramatic. It was one of the first papers on climate change impacts on forest, and it was total silence. It got no attention. It was in Nature, which for those of you in the science world is a high-impact journal, and just nobody cared. It just didn't seem to make a difference. It helped me. It helped me get tenure because it was a high visibility journal, but it didn't really have much on the community. But what really struck me in this story is I went back, I maintained these plots I'd set up in 1970s, late 70s. And I went back only 30 years later and I started seeing on the ground in the forest the impacts that I had talked about and projected. And that really started to be scary. Because I thought of these forest changes as way off in the distance, and yet I was seeing it. I didn't think that was going to be my lifetime. It was my lifetime. I was still pretty vigorous then. And so, you know, we look around the world, and a lot of this is real. It's happening. It's dramatic. I've spent time in Mongolia where the permafrost is melting at the southern end of the permafrost range, and you look at the buildings and they're turning sideways, and Mike can speak to, he knows the Arctic really well. So there's a lot of these impacts that are real. They're substantive. We're observing them. We're seeing rainfall patterns. I look at the record we have at Hubbard Brook, which is one of the most intensively studied forests. I did a paper on it, 50 years of impact. We predicted everything from the models. What should we see in the data? We didn't look at the data. We just put a list. And then we looked at all the data, and almost without exception, we saw all of the things we thought. Not all of them were significant changes, but the pattern was there, it was real, and it was absolute. There was no ambiguity about it. I see it in the maple syrup producers, and we can go around the world, whether we're talking about coral or South Florida. So these things are real, so it's pretty bummer, right? We'd all, oh my God, what are you doing? But I think there is an optimistic story in here. Not that that isn't happening and that it won't get worse, because it will. But in the fact that over the 44 years that I've been aware of and thinking about this problem, we're starting to see a path forward in a way that I don't think we've seen before. And we're going to talk a little bit about that path forward. And we have to both, so it's a yin-yang. We got this thing that's happening that's real, it's significant, it's concerning. We're going to have to adapt, and we can't avoid that, but we also have to double down on mitigation. But there is a path forward that now allows us to think about a future that isn't nearly as dire as we might otherwise think. Will it be pretty? No, but it's not going to be catastrophic if we get our act together, and we're seeing lots of opportunities. So we can talk about those pathways. We can also talk about, I'll put a teaser out, and maybe we'll come back after Steve. We're in the middle of designing, building, and about to launch in 2 years a satellite to measure methane to hold the world's oil and gas industry responsible for their methane emissions, which account for, in the aggregate, 1/4 of the warming we're experiencing today. And we think we're already seeing the industry greatly respond to that and starting to reduce and commit to reduce their emissions. So there are things that we can do. There are things that are being done. But I'm going to turn over to Steve, and then we'll do a little back and forth and then open it up.
So like Steve, I've spent a lifetime studying climate change. I've worked on all kinds of problems in the field, but also build climate models. And it's a relenting sort of parade of bad news, right? It's a recipe for being bummed out for your entire life. I'm going to get around to something better, but it is. And through my lifetime, as we've learned more, the news has been almost uniformly bad, right? So the stringency of the targets keeps coming down because our awareness of the damages keeps going up. So much so that unlike other problems where the biggest experts are usually not the most concerned, right? Because there's hype on both sides of a problem in the public, and they see it in the climate business, the people who know the most about it are the most concerned. And one of the reasons they're concerned is that they're aware of twitchy positive feedbacks in the climate system that they don't fully understand, where something really dramatic could happen, and so this has really been a dire problem to study. On the other hand, there's been a fundamental change in the last 3 years. Prior to 3 years ago, if somebody asked me, how would you solve the carbon and climate problem at a cost that wouldn't leave people in poverty, and that, you know, that wouldn't hurt struggling people in the middle class in the West and people who are trying to climb out of poverty elsewhere in the world, I'd say, well, the answer is we don't have the technology to go to endgame. Endgame means no net anthropogenic greenhouse gases, period, emitted. We don't have the technology, and we're going to have to get started and keep innovating all along the way and hope that we invent some technology that will allow us to do this. But about 3 years ago, that picture changed, and in a way that most Americans don't know. There has been a technological revolution in energy technologies that people need to be aware of. So in the last 10 years, the cost of wind electricity has fallen by 3/4, and the cost of solar electricity has fallen by 2/3. In the right locations, they are far and away the cheapest forms of energy we have, much, much cheaper than a coal-fired power plant that you've already paid off. It's cheaper to build a new wind turbine than to keep a nuclear plant you've already paid for running, okay? At the same time, there was an 85% drop in the price of batteries to power transport vehicles, so that now all the big oil and gas companies see the end of the price of oil because the middle and light duty vehicle segments are electrifying, all right? And so this has sort of fundamentally changed their incentive to lobby. That big market is going away. At the same time, and this is a mixed environmental value, the natural gas supply in the world exploded with the fracking revolution. And the downside is, of course, the environmental problems. You've heard about fracking. But the upside is that natural gas is a fuel where it's possible to use carbon capture and storage to back up renewables until we have something better. All right. And natural gas is, of course, produced by oil and gas producers, and it gives them an extra incentive to try to be part of a clean economy. And so those are the foundations of a non-emitting energy economy. The U.S. is the best-resourced nation in the world to implement it, and at a cost, I want to emphasize again, about what consumers pay today. When somebody tells you this is going to cost $90 trillion, they aren't telling you the truth, all right? So we have the tools, finally, that we need to get this job done, and I think it's time to go to endgame. Fortunately, there has been a sea change in public opinion inside the U.S. You've probably read about it recently. The number one issue in the primary season, but also polling across the board, looks like this is a social norm that's changing, much the way gay marriage's social norm changed. And the sooner, the better.
And the implementation of what Steve's talking about, so you can't go, so just to make it clear, it's not like we can now today go to 100% renewables. But we can go a long way there. And actually Steve's leading a project to try and figure that out, and I'm leading a parallel project. What do these pathways look like? And the way that I live, over just a little recently, we've been starting to characterize, it's a common beginning with different endings. So we don't quite know what the ending looks like, but we can get a long way down that road. And I mentioned methane earlier. So one of the things that EDF really sort of doubled down on starting about 8 years ago, and Steve was a co-conspirator in that early in this work, was recognizing that nobody was focusing much on reducing methane. And so the way I like to think about it is we have two climate problems. We have the long-lived climate pollutants like CO2, which is critically important. That's going to determine the long-term, what's the maximum warming. That really matters. But it also matters how fast things are warming and the feedbacks that we're getting. That's actually driven more by short-lived pollutants like methane that don't stay up in the atmosphere that long. But they're really important, accounting for this, you know, roughly a third or more of the total pollution of warming that we're experiencing. So we thought about the problem and said, here's an opportunity. Here's an enormous lever to affect change that's invisible to most people. If we can make it visible, give them data, we can start pushing down on that lever and starting to see the reductions. And me, in my lifetime, will see the impact. So I think of it as a solution to what I will see and my daughter will see, while we'll work on the solutions to what my grandchildren's grandchildren will see. We have to do both. It's not one or the other. But in that, we started to recognize that we didn't know enough about methane emissions, particularly from oil and gas, but across the board, to set up effective policy. So EDF made a big bet that I'm really proud of EDF for doing. I was part of it, but it was Fred Krupp, the president, who said, we're all in. We developed a $20 million science project, pure science, with a couple of hundred of scientists across the U.S. to get the data, to understand where the problem was, quantify it, and find the solutions. And so we've done that. We've published that. We had a paper in Science this past summer that gave the results. And to get the attention of the oil and gas industry, to get them to commit that and recognize the emissions were much higher than they thought, and they have the power to reduce them. So the good news is 13 of the biggest oil and gas companies in the world, producing roughly a third of global oil and gas production, have taken a formal commitment to reduce their emissions to a very low level. Now, they think their emissions are already close. We have the data to show they're not, but we won't argue with them, and because then we're going to have the satellite to show what they're doing, because they took an absolute target. They said, our emissions will not exceed 0.25% and down to 0.2%, and we think they're more closer to more like 1.8% now, at least in the U.S., and we think that's probably a pretty good representation globally. And so with a big advocacy team, we're doing the science. The advocacy team is going out, talking to the companies, driving it, getting the commitments. Fred's met with an enormous number of CEOs, and we're changing the attitudes. Every single CEO at the World Gas Conference last June here in D.C. talked about methane, talked about the need to reduce it. That's about making an impact. That's how we affect that more rapid change that I just thought was a dream before. Will it be enough right now? No. Will the climate get warmer? Absolutely. But the key is putting the brakes on it quickly and effectively while we adapt. Will Florida have trouble? Absolutely. We can't prevent that. What we can do is prevent it from being even worse. I don't know, Steve, you want to say any more before we open it up?
Yeah, I just want to add a little bit more. And this is this is the reason that I give my time to EDF, right? So you probably heard of the 1.5-degree target instead of the 2-degree target, and how much more daunting that is, how difficult it is globally. It takes a titanic effort of every nation in the world to get that, to limit it to 2 degrees and to get down to 1.5, how difficult that is. EDF surgically figured out an area where governments weren't doing anything, raised private capital to do it, did it, convinced the major oil companies of the world, including Saudi Aramco and ExxonMobil, to accept this draconian target, building and launching a satellite to police their competitors also, so that no one can free ride on a target like that, and ultimately to have a price on dirty or a standard for dirty versus clean gas, is where this is all going. There is a theory of victory here that I think is going to work. And when it does, and the oil and gas methane is 0.2% across the board, that is 1/3 of the way between 1.5 and 2 degrees. That's how big that single action is. A small group of people committed using evidence-based reasoning relentlessly is going to single-handedly do 1/3 of a global job. And that's why I give them a lot of time. Right.
So, yeah, let's open it up. If I would ask, if you could state your name, and we're going to have some mics going around. If you just wait for the mic so that others can hear, that would be great. We'll start here on the side.
Hi, my name is Krista Kurth, and a longtime member and environmentalist. So I have two questions. One is EDF doing anything around methane in agriculture? Because this is another huge emitter of methane. And the other one is, you know, we're talking about getting to net zero, but there's in emissions, but there's still, we're still in trouble even if we get to net zero. We need to, we're going to have long-term warming anyway. So is EDF doing anything around drawing carbon out of the atmosphere, sort of negative emissions, so to speak?
So I'll start with that. So in terms of the ag and what we're doing on ag methane, so we have been working some on ag methane. We are more focused on oil and gas because you can reduce oil and gas emissions, the current estimate is, by half at no cost. No cost, not low cost, no cost. So that's a powerful, and you can probably get 75% reductions at low cost. So we have the technology, the economics are in our favor, and we now have the data. That doesn't in any way diminish the role that ag methane plays, which is important. So we have done two things so far on that. One is we've worked on enteric fermentation, so from cattle, ruminants, tried to take the same approach we took with oil. Well, we did take the same approach we took with oil and gas to really try and understand how well were we estimating it and making sure that we understood the sources well. And so we did a series of studies out in California on dairies and cattle and manure, and were able to greatly improve our understanding of the sourcing of that. We have not pursued that further because there are some techniques for reducing methane from cows that are coming along. They're complicated to implement. There's some great things in the pipeline, but they're not yet mature. And so we decided we couldn't see where our role, how could we help catalyze it. So we follow it. Some of my staff follow it regularly. And if we see that opportunity, we will jump in. But at the moment, there are some good things coming along, but it's not going to be as great. Remind me on the second.
The second was about negative.
Negative emissions, right. So I'll talk, and then I know Steve will probably want to comment on that. So we are involved. We've been following the issue for many years. I've served on a National Academy of Sciences panel that dealt with it. Steve chaired the most recent one that dealt with it. That was a few years ago. We currently think about it. I've got a joint project with some academics to look at some ways of potentially scaling things up. We work, of course, on forest policy, which is a form of negative emissions. So we think that's important, and I'll let Steve talk about how it fits into the budget. But for the most part, a lot of this is still in the distance. So we are currently thinking about ways of encouraging. We've been working with other organizations to get the Hill to support research and those kinds of things. But I'll turn it over to Steve to.
Yeah, so it's there's a not very well understood part of the science that makes it not true that if you get to net zero emissions, then that you're stuck with the CO2 concentration you have. We have natural sinks, natural carbon sinks that remove CO2 from the atmosphere that are operating all the time. And they're capturing and sequestering for free about half the CO2 we release from fossil fuels. So if you get to net zero in and we know quite a bit about these. There's a big one in the ocean and there's a big one in the terrestrial biosphere, primarily in forests. So if we get to net zero anthropogenic, the a common scenario that is Paris compliant would have us peak. We're currently at about 410 parts per million of CO2, would have us peak at about 445, which is a little bit too high, right? But then we reach net zero. And then what happens? Over the next century or so, the atmospheric concentration of CO2 falls by 75 parts per million, down to between 350 and 375, simply because of the inertia, the continued action of these natural carbon sinks. So nature is our friend here. We've got to protect those carbon sinks to the extent that we can, and they will help us reduce the atmospheric CO2 without net negative emissions anthropogenically.
Yeah, hi, Steve and Mike. I met you before. Mike Jamalkowski. I'm about a 45-year meteorologist, and so is my wife here, but she wouldn't admit to that. And I have 2 points. One, I would like to congratulate you for pursuing the satellite monitoring. I'm a satellite environmentalist, satellite meteorologist, for monitoring methane, because if you remember back in the 70s, 80s, we had a thing called the ozone hole. And one of the things we did for that was...
Regrettably, we still have it. It's just not as... It's getting better.
But we're reducing that, yeah. And we did a couple of things. We did some political things like, I think it was the Montreal Protocols.
Right.
And we had NASA monitoring that. And I worked on a couple of programs, NOAA programs that monitor that. So that's a big deal. And I think that's the right way to go. My second point on the methane, though, is there are other sources that this is like a double whammy. We have global warming that is reducing the ice caps, and especially in the Arctic Ocean, where there's countries now looking at deriving resources from the ocean bottom, which is a terrible source, or a good source, depending on how you look at it, of methane. So is that another area that you're looking at to possibly reduce that?
Well, so we're talking about methane hydrates, mining methane hydrates. You're talking about methane, mining methane hydrates?
Right.
Yeah, so there's an effort. The leading proponent of it is Japan, which is fossil fuel free, so to speak, not because they don't burn it, because they don't own any of it. And so they have been pushing a methane hydrate mining, which I've spent some time with folks who are experts. I'm not an expert on methane hydrate, who have convinced me that this is more political show than reality. So at least for the foreseeable future and until we find experts who think that this is really going to be anywhere close to cost effective, we're not convinced that methane hydrates are going to be a source of a lot of methane. There's other mining in the Arctic that could be a big problem, but you know, when you're sitting in a place when you don't have resources and you're importing them, you want to show your population that you're trying to become independent and self-reliant. And I'm not aware. I don't know, Steve, if you know, there's just nothing out there that says that energetically. And then there's some concern that, okay, these methane hydrates are going to start to blow up methane off. And again, from the ocean bottom ones, that's, I think we're quite a ways away. And if we do have the trajectory of a 2 degree, I think we might have dodged that bullet.
So the answer, right, also is that natural gas is is currently dirt cheap. And so mining methane hydrates is nothing if not expensive. Right.
One here, and we'll go to somebody in the back. So, go. I'm trying to mix it up. Okay. Right. Go. I think it's there. Oh, we'll keep moving around. Sorry.
Yeah, Steve. Could you my name is Paul Kaplowitz. Could you elaborate a little on the technology that will allow us to reduce methane from oil and gas production by 50 to 75%?
Sure. So basically, it's doing what you already do well and knowing when you did it well. So what happens is we've measured methane emissions from a diversity of infrastructure across the United States. And what we find is if you just look at the amount per site, whether it's a well or a compressor station or whatever, you find roughly, it's not exactly that, but roughly a third of the sites are really close to zero. They're effectively de minimis. So you get just very little. And the real issue is that historically the oil and gas companies didn't keep the data to figure out what are they doing there that works versus where, a place where you're blowing off lots. And they just didn't keep it. You had somebody responsible and one person did it well and somebody didn't, and they didn't know why one was working and one doesn't. So what we're really encouraging them and pushing the industry is they start to collect that data. A metaphor that one of my colleagues uses, which I like, is the airline industry. You know, they do a lot of forensics, right? Anything goes wrong on a plane, they figure out why. And we've ended up, despite the Boeing MAX issue, we still have an amazingly safe airline industry across the globe. And that's because they go after it and they fix it and they make sure they prevent a maintenance that happens across the industry. That was totally absent in the oil and gas industry. And because you're saving product, so if you're venting that off and you're losing it, that's income. You put it into sales, you just get it back into the pipe, you've got income to match it, plus your maintenance, if you're doing it predictively, you have a probabilistic understanding of what's going wrong. Now your maintenance costs should go down because now you're seeing it ahead of time. You're doing it as routine maintenance versus repairs, which are more expensive. So, and you also, they're developing, which we've been involved with, is developing new technology, catalyzing that so that they can start to see things happening ahead of time. Data makes good for good management. They had no data.
I'm going to apologize right off the bat because I'm not the EDF member. My wife is, and I'm here for moral support. But my question is...
Could you provide your name, please? Sorry.
Bill McNaught.
Hi, Bill.
What is the EDF doing on deforestation?
So we do a lot. We've been working on deforestation for a long period of time. Steve Schwartzman, who leads our red team, has been in, I'm going to look to Sam, how 30 years? About 30 years. Yeah, so Steve's been working on deforestation in the Amazon for about 30 years. He was a close colleague of Chico Mendes, who some of you may know. He worked with him very closely, and he has been working with indigenous communities as well as across Brazil, helping to found NGOs in Brazil, indigenous NGOs, to help develop the what up until now, we have obviously got some worries with the new government there, but a dramatic reduction in the rate of deforestation in Amazonia. And I think EDF, and I wasn't part of it, so I can say that I've been at EDF 11 years, that program, EDF has played a vital role, not alone, with a lot of other people, but a vital role in helping to reduce that deforestation, which is absolutely critical from a climate standpoint and also critical from a biodiversity standpoint and also from a cultural, because the indigenous communities in that area depend on having intact forests to survive.
Hi, I'm Elliot Roseman, and with the United States Energy Association. I've been working in this area for quite some time as well. I want to ask you a policy question.
You got two scientists here, so we'll try.
Right. Well, the science seems pretty settled, right? I mean, there's not probably many people in this room that question whether or not climate change is actually happening or happening at an accelerating rate. So the question revolves around the fact that most of the additional greenhouse gas emissions are going to be coming from other parts of the world. And as you know, in the Paris Accords, there was a lot of discussion about a fund that would be used. But even a number of oil companies now are agreeing to put a price on carbon. And so...
A shadow price.
And some of them an actual price, an actual auction. And,
well, and they're recommending it. I mean, they're supporting it. Right.
Shell has pulled out of companies, out of organizations that don't advocate that. Yep. You know, so the question is, could there be a price on carbon? We tax things that are undesirable all the time, that would not break the bank, that would not put people into poverty, and that could be used to subsidize low-cost, no-cost reductions or elimination of emissions in the places where it really matters. China's building 800 new coal plants on the books. How do we kind of mitigate those kinds of issues? How are we? What are we doing to in the areas in the world where it really matters? And isn't there a fund that could be set up to capture and to combat that?
So there are a couple questions in that question. So one, and I'm going to put one aside, the tax aside, the question of a tax. But to China, so EDF has been in China for 25 years, working all of that time on climate. So they have the largest carbon market in the world. We were there by their side, helping them think it through, design it. We run with them jointly with Tsinghua the carbon climate modeling effort, energy modeling effort of in China to help them understand these things. So we've been working extensively in China. We have an office with about 30 staff working very closely with the Chinese government to get through that. So in terms of coal plants, they get the problem with coal. I guarantee you. So they're looking at gas. They're looking at, you know, they're the biggest users and producers of renewable energy. They're the biggest right now producers of new nuclear plants. And I've spent enough time in the last year in China that if you go into coal regions, which I've done and met with provincial leaders, they know they've got to reduce their coal because they're also under enormous political pressure to get their air pollution under control. And they can't do that with the coal. And the local, even in regions that are coal-based, know they have to find alternative pathways. And we've spent time with them talking through this, right? They're looking for help. We're not going to let us do it, but they will listen, and they do. And we just today I was hiring a scientist to work in China, to work with the industry there, to help them build the capacity to understand these problems. So they get it. They're working on it. They got to do it quickly, obviously, but they have an incentive. And while it's coming through air pollution, you bet it's strong. They're pushing hard, and they know they can't do it through the coal model. It just isn't going to work. Even though they've reduced the sulfur, that isn't the future. So I think that there is optimism. And if you take care of China, Europe, the U.S., and India, we've been in India for 10 years, but we're ramping up our work. You've got the bulk of the problem, not all of it. But that is the bulk, and if those countries and groups of countries set the stage, that will flow, particularly the model that Steve talked about, where we can do it at low cost, where equity is at the center of what we're doing. It's not about 4x cost. It's about making it so people really can't afford it. That has to be the model. That's the model which we now see. We can touch it and see it, so that really matters. In terms of carbon, we've always been for a price on carbon at EDF. We were we were bet big on Waxman-Markey on a cap and trade bill. We were formal co-sponsors of California. In California, you can actually be an NGO and be a co-sponsor a bill of the cap and trade program in California. We have a large team. My counterpart, the chief economist, got a whole team working on how to find the right mechanisms to put a price on carbon to ensure you get those incentives. So we're very supportive of that. We recognize that's not all, you can't just put a price on carbon, but it's a critical part of the what we need to do. I don't know if you want to say anything, Steve.
Just two little points. If you hear a scary statistic about climate change and the impacts, it's almost certainly true and probably is an underestimate. If you hear a scary story about what China is going to do, like 800 coal plants, it almost certainly is old news, and that the Chinese government has already changed its plans. They move very quickly there, and there is a fundamental change in the attitude towards coal and the relative merits of a coal versus, say, natural gas and nuclear and renewables economy in China just in the last few months. So that's the first thing. The second thing is India is at a much, much earlier stage, and it's a very different sort of society. But one optimistic factoid about India is that in the last 3 months, there has been a bit of a brouhaha because the coal electrification targets on the entire eastern seaboard have fallen short. And it's because the renewables have gotten too cheap.
And just in terms of one more thing on the China coal thing. So because of the air pollution, a lot of the coal gets burned
in decentralized way, not just in the power plant, but in heating. And I've talked enough with government officials, because we're working on air quality in China with a series of efforts, that they recognize they've got to figure that out. There's a black market for coal. You can go to Beijing. I did it just about a year ago, a little over a year ago. I was in Beijing. And on a cold night, even in Beijing, you're smelling the coal because people are trying to heat their homes. And there, I don't know if it's an apocryphal story or not. There are headlines about people dying because they didn't have access to coal. So there's this tension right now that they're working to that coal isn't your solution to heating your home. So they're trying to get the infrastructure, get enough gas, get enough renewables, get electric. And they get that because they're not going to meet their air quality standards if individuals are buying coal. So even in China, with its central economy and authoritarian rule, they've got to get that under control. They know it, and they're pushing doubly hard to do it because they know that they can't afford. They can't be a global city when people move out because the air quality is so bad and they don't want to live there. So you guarantee every citizen of every city in China knows what their average PM 2.5 level is. And if it isn't coming down, that politician running that city isn't going to last long. And coal and getting rid of it is one of the key ways they got to do it to make that happen. And they get it. So there is some optimism. Doesn't mean they got a big nut to crack. They got a long way to go. But you're seeing a lot of developments that are going in the right direction, particularly that carbon market on a national scale. Go to the over here. Oh, we got. How about right here?
It was heartening to hear about the natural carbon sinks. But to what extent do these projections take into account that in every other way, we're society, or not in every, but in many ways, is going in the wrong direction? Our population is growing. Living standards are rising, and people are eating more meat and better food and having their houses warmer. We may be slowing down the deforestation in Brazil, but we're still cutting hundreds of thousands of acres a year. I mean, I don't know what the number is, but it's still going on. There's just so much that's going in the wrong direction with population growth and higher living standards. The question is, to what extent does that offset the rosier view that you all have expressed?
So absolutely, population has an impact, and that's we have to consider that, and it's real. But it isn't always as linear. You know, the 60s, Paul Ehrlich and the population bomb raised an important issue but didn't get it right. So he and John Holdren came up with the IPAT equation, if you may know about it. Impact equals population times affluence times technology. And the demographers push back against that. There's a strong cultural element to that. It isn't inevitable just because you have more people, it's how you live. And that with this new technology and the cultural imperatives, in a lot of cases you can increase. It's not inevitable, but it can increase in ways that do not just straight multiplier times the number of people. So that's the positive, and every demographer I know is like, whoa, you know, there are ways. We got to do it. So you're absolutely right. In terms of meat, absolutely. That's a big issue. So as I spend time in parts of Asia where they need more protein, you know, from a health standpoint. So do we have to reduce our meat consumption in the U.S.? That would be great. It'd be good for our health. It'd be good for the climate. It would be good. Are there other parts of the world that need more protein? We work on oceans extensively to try and ensure that the oceans are healthier, producing more fish, more livelihood for the fishers, the people working on these. We have to do all those. So you're absolutely right. Are there concomitant sort of issues? Absolutely. But I don't think it's as inevitable as you think. But we still have to make good decisions. So if we make the bad decisions, you bet. We're now going backwards where we're trying to go forwards.
Thank you, Alan Greenberg. I wanted to, in the U.S., the transport sector, as you know, has taken over as the leading carbon emitter. And the push to electrify surface transportation aside, last year there were over 17 million vehicles sold in the U.S. Only 1% was electric, roughly. Over two-thirds were SUVs. That fleet's going to be around for a long time. And so my question is, there's, you know, movements for congestion pricing in New York, which is great, but it's very affects only a very small number of trips. If you survey the public about raising gas prices a lot, they're very negative about that. But there's a couple of big hits that seem to be right in EDF's bailiwick, and that is if you repriced insurance and made it mileage-based, and if you took away employers' rights to give people only car parking. I was involved in a modeling study that looked at those two plus a third strategy, and we got about 70% of the emissions reductions of the Clean Power Plan just by repricing surface transportation, not by adding a single cent to the cost of driving. And I would encourage EDF to sort of think about maybe taking some leadership in that area. Thank you.
So we've been at the heart of the congestion pricing in New York. We worked on it assiduously 10 years ago. We didn't get it in, and then we were ready to go when the opportunity reemerged. So that we've looked at vehicle mile transport taxing insurance schemes. I'm not an expert, and I'm going to look in the room to see if there's any of my colleagues here who know more about it. We have looked at those kinds of mechanisms. LG, do you want to... You ducked on vehicle mile transport tax. Nope, he's shaking his head no. So absolutely, those are important issues, and the transport sector is critically important. And while the 1%, remember, growth looks slow and absolute as it's building, right? And so things are changing. And I don't know, Steve, if you want to jump in on any of the numbers.
Yeah, that if you sound like a quant, that 1%. Growth, if you plot it on a log plot, is a semi-log plot, rather, is a line. That's an exponential growing fraction. And, you know, most of the major manufacturers of cars have declared an all-electric future. And a bunch of countries, huge countries, countries like China, have signaled that they've got an all-electric future. And the technology, in my view, is superior. And the charging technology is almost there to be comparable in terms of what a consumer would see to refilling a gasoline tank. So I personally think this is inevitable. We're going to see a revolution in transport technology over the next 30 years, no matter what we do. Autonomous cars, shared ownership, and electrification. And so when something gets shaken up that much, there's really an opportunity to shape it for environmental ends. And I think that this is one sector where there was no solution 15 years ago. Right? All these distributed sources of CO2, oh my God, what are we going to do? And now we have an answer.
Steve, I won't completely duck you on this.
Okay. So, why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm LG Holstein. I work just upstairs in the political affairs part of EDF. And what I'll say is that we're very much aware that fundamental changes are happening and need to happen in the transportation sector. Now, the lowest hanging fruit for electrification is probably in the heavy duty part of the fleet. But at the same time, we're seeing multiple vehicle manufacturers around the world making cars and even pickup trucks for electrification, and the charging apparatus is getting rapidly better. So you've probably heard the phrase range anxiety. Can I drive from here to New York City and make it if I have an all-electric vehicle? Will the car be big enough and comfortable enough and fast enough? The answers to all those questions is yes or almost yes. And so what we're working on is a plan, if we can ever get Congress and the President to actually get going on an infrastructure bill, this is a high priority for us, is to move forward and start a national program to start putting in a national network of charging stations. And as Steve pointed out, there are enormous opportunities here to build on a network like that, for example, using renewables linked to storage, linked to charging infrastructure. So there's a lot of exciting things happening there, and yes, we are working on those. Thanks.
My name is John Hansen, and my question is, what is EDF's take on and role in, if any, in the New Democrats' Green New Deal?
Ah, is LG? Did he disappear on me? No, there you go.
I should have. I think the short answer is that the Green New Deal has probably injected more energy, political energy, psychic energy, you name it, into the discussion about climate change and clean energy than we've seen in a very long time. And so we have welcomed that energy without getting into these partisan fights about the details of the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal isn't even a bill. It's really a resolution with a bunch of ideas in it, some of which relate directly to climate and clean energy, and some of which are pretty tangential. So the short answer is we've welcomed the hubbub that the Green New Deal has brought about in terms of really enlivening the political discussion, and we think that's a good thing, and we think it's actually showing up in the polls in terms of people paying attention to climate. So that I think is a good thing on balance, and I think there will be more discussions and probably more partisanship, but to some extent, if it's driving a public debate and press coverage and debates on the floor of the House and the Senate, those are all good things, and they represent some advances in our fight that we have been waiting for a long time to see.
And I'll just add towards that, and I don't know, Steve, you may want to add. So one of the things that also it raises is it gives us the specter to take some of these ideas we talked about of doing low-cost, zero-carbon energy, thinking of it a new way, and you can say, we can meet those targets. Maybe not the way the new Green Deal, but we can maybe almost do better. And so having opened that conversation is in a powerful way to introduce these new ideas that are just emerging. I mean, this kind of thing that we were talking about isn't out there. We're developing the primary data to show these exist, working with teams. The good news is a lot of people get it. So we're working with the diversity of experts across the U.S. to make this case, to say we can do it. And it isn't just hyperbole, and it isn't, you know, super expensive that we have to invest, you know, everybody has to, you know, cut their standard of living.
I'd just like to add that I was on the Hill doing briefings when the Green New Deal was released. And I can tell you that what I know to be feasible went from fringe to centrist on that day. And so that's an enormous service to humankind that they did.
Back there. Hi, Chuck Tobler. Just a quick question. You'd said earlier that some of the largest energy producers were on board with reducing methane.
Absolutely.
And that's great. What's your sense as to why other energy producers aren't really on board with reducing, especially when you said a lot of it can be done at no cost or very low cost? What is your general take on why some people don't want to play ball, I guess?
Why don't you start, Steve, since you've talked to a lot of them about this.
Yeah, I talked to a lot of them about this. A lot of it is just, it's long-term ignorance about the issue. Natural gas for a long time in the oil business was the fluid you didn't want, all right? And so you're constantly having to clean out your well and all the gas get to the atmosphere, right? And so this is why the equipment was shoddily maintained. They have pressure relief valves on condensate tanks that would stick open and, you know, be open for days and nobody would. So those days have changed, but that culture changes slowly. And the companies have a tremendous range of technological expertise. The big companies Steve's talking about are the biggest oil companies in the world, and they have just frightfully advanced technologies. But there's something like, 17 or 20,000 independent oil and gas producers in the United States, and it just takes a long time to trickle down to the mom and pops.
And even on the global scale, the level of sophistication varies widely. So we've been working with some of these companies, national oil companies, who just doesn't have the sophistication. But they are approaching us. And, of course, as an NGO, to be honest, you know, we're not their normal ally. So sometimes it takes a little while, but then they realize, yeah, we're gonna call them out, but we succeed when they succeed. So We'll call them out with the satellite. We'll present the data. But if you can get to a good place before that, we'll help you on that journey. So we've had that. We're getting invited, as I mentioned, to go to companies that we never would have gotten invited to. Or they come to us. Hey, we want to talk. So it's spreading. So the original companies, we're only talking. This is a revolution in what's happened. We went from, I think my first meeting and the very first time was actually a meeting that Steve held at Princeton. And some of the folks there called me up and said, hey, come to Paris and talk about this. And that's the very first conversations. They made the commitment in less than 3 years after that. We've had conversations, all the names. I won't get into details here, but all the names you can think of, we've talked to them. Several of them are going to help us make it a reality. Because we are in the final stages, we've announced publicly that we have two companies that were competing for the contract, Ball Aerospace and Space Systems Loral. We worked with 20, and we narrowed it down to two who are competing, and we're very close to announcing, we're not quite there yet, to announce the winner and have a contract signed. Once we do that, we will have all of the specifications tied down. We know exactly its size and weight. Once we have that, because it matters, if it's a little bigger, a little heavier, it's a different rocket, they're not all rockets were created equal, and then we will be negotiating in earnest rather than now we have conversations with them, but we can't pick which company we want to work with to launch it until we know those specs, because they're not going to give us a price. They're not, you know, so that's where we are with it. But there was a question further back. I know that there, yeah, please. And then there's one over here that I saw a hand.
Okay. Yeah, my name is Bruce Thornburg. If you'll indulge me with a remedial question, is there some estimate of how much the petroleum industry wastes in just their operation of from the time they take it out of the ground to the time they put it in your gas tank?
Yeah, so that we have. So that's the paper we published. Not from your gasoline. That I'd have to do a calculation. I don't know that off the top of my head. But from natural gas, so if you're a natural gas user, as I am, I heat my house in Providence, Rhode Island with natural gas. When it comes out of the ground till it gets to me in Providence, on average, now it's going to depend on where it literally came from, but on average in the United States, 2.3% of that gas, that methane will be in the atmosphere before it gets to me. So I receive 97.7% at my house. Now there's an additional issue of when I burn it in my boiler, whether there's some leakage associated that and including the pipes in my house. That doesn't include those. We're working on a series of studies right now to quantify that because we do not have that fully under control right now. But it's 2.3%. It sounds not too bad. And yet that literally doubles the climate impact of my burning that natural gas over 20 years, essentially. So that methane is equal to the impact of that CO2 over 20 years. Now it's less over a long period of time because the methane breaks down, but it's a big impact. And that 2.3, we need to have down around 0.3 or something like that. And if it's 0.3, we're almost 90% reduced, and that is doable. That's what's amazing. It is doable with existing technology. No magic needs. You don't need magical thinking. We don't need some new technology we don't know to do it. Question here.
Thank you very much. My name is Judith Sefkin. I would describe my role as concerned citizen. Previously, I worked in diplomacy, most recently in the South Pacific, where I spent a lot of time on the issue of climate change and coordinating with Pacific Island countries to get TS in Paris. But I have a two-part question. The first is, as a concerned citizen, in addition to donating money to EDF and other organizations such as yours that are doing good work in this area and doing the best, you know, we can to lower our own carbon footprint, what can we do to be part of the solution? The second part of the question is, there are a lot of organizations in addition to EDF that are doing good work in this area. How much are you coordinating? And, you know, are there particular organizations that have a particular advantage in certain areas? I'd just be interested in how you see that landscape.
So absolutely, we're coordinating. This isn't something you do solo. We're only going to do this as a large community, and not just environmental organizations, civil society. I was at a meeting about 2 weeks ago with somebody I work with from Red Cross, Red Crescent. and CARE, and there are other groups. And so we have to do this. This is a civil society. This is a humanity issue. This is, you know, this reaches across. There are a lot of refugees. So absolutely, we try and work extensively with our groups wherever we can, because we need to make common cause. In this case, we were talking about with the methane, working with the corporate sector. So it's not just with nonprofits. We have to find whoever we can make common cause with. And we don't have to agree on everything. With the private, with these oil and gas companies, we can agree on reducing methane and disagree on how long fossil fuels should last. And that's okay. We're not saying we endorse. And I used, when I came to EDF 11 years ago, one of the things that impressed me was Duke Energy. We were doing a lot of work on U.S. CAP, trying to get Waxman-Markey passed, and we were also suing them at the same time. They were an active phase, right? So you can, as long as the ground rules, you're straight. I don't know if you want to talk about what people can do or want to add anything.
Sure. You can go on almost any website and find out what you can do in your personal life, and that's a decision that is important for each person to make. But as a citizen, what we need to do is hold our elected leaders accountable. And I know all of you vote, but perhaps some of your kids don't, right? And so everybody has to vote. Because at the end of the day, the atmosphere is a commons, and it's going to take a cooperative to deal with it, all right? And so this means that individuals have to bind together, and we do that currently in governments. Also, just with the cooperative as a metaphor, it is useful to understand that the community of people trying to solve the climate and other environmental problems, there are many, many groups. And these are cooperatives. Everybody is trying something a little different. And most of those efforts, almost all of those efforts, will fail. But that's okay as long as one finally succeeds, all right? So think of these groups as a cooperative, because they are, even when they're not actively coordinating, and they also actively coordinate.
And the only thing I would add is a point that Steve made earlier about shifting norms. So one of the things that's really critical is that we in our own networks, whatever they be, whether we're a church or a social group or just our neighborhood, are trying to make sure that we reach out. And it can sometimes feel uncomfortable, and I'll just tell a story about what I did quite a few years ago. I was doing a lot of work, actually, with EDF. I was still at Brown University as a professor, and I knew Fred, and he invited me to go meet with the CEO of Walmart, and I got to working with Walmart, and I told the CEO I don't shop at Walmart at the point. I'd literally only been one store in my life. And so I worked on getting efficient light bulbs in Walmart stores, and they ended up being the international leader on converting and allowed literally legislation in the U.S. to phase out incandescent light bulbs, because Walmart showed it could be done. In 1 year, they saturated their market, and they were responsible for 1/4 of the light bulbs sold in America. But the key here was the story I wanted to say was, so I was thinking a lot about light bulbs, and so we were having a party at our house. And, you know, it's on my brain. I'm thinking about it. I'm trying to get America, you know, literally we were trying to get 100 million households in America to put these efficient light bulbs in. And so I said to my wife, I think what I'll do is I'll buy a bunch of efficient light bulbs and I'll put in a basket next to the door so people can take them. And I'm a little nervous, right, that I'm being preachy, that my friends are going to get a little upset with me. I'm bringing my day job home. So I did this, and people took them, and I was still a little nervous on how our friends were reacting. And the next day, I saw a friend on the street, and they said, I couldn't come, but I want my light bulbs. And I knew it worked. And we did it the next year, and most of them said, don't need it, I've already changed. And then I started going to churches and work meeting if they offered, and having the same conversation and saying, the only reason I'll come if you have to invite me back in a year and tell me what you did. And it became comfortable. I realized that I could have that conversation as long as I was direct. And I think more of us forget how we do our networks. We can change the norms. We don't have to be preachy, but we just show, this is what I care about. And I'd love to have a conversation, or I'd love to help you. And if more of us do that outreach and say, these are things I care about, and I hope maybe I can have a conversation, is this something you care about? Or if not, why not? And it doesn't matter if they're voted for Trump or whatever, it's just whoever we know. And, you know, my brother-in-law voted for Trump, I'm sure. He didn't say it, but I'm sure he did. He's definitely has a different perspective on the world, but he put efficient lighting in his house when he moved into a new house because he got it, right? I didn't have to agree politically with him to get him to realize that this made sense. And part of that was because, hey, this was Walmart. I was working with the CEO of Walmart. We're going to thank Steve, who has to take off for the airport, I think.
I was going to stay for another couple of minutes.
Okay, then I won't. I thought you were headed out.
I've got an 8:30 train, and the traffic is lousy, so I'm going to take off in exactly 5 minutes.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah, we got one. Oh, sorry, okay. Over there.
Hi. Yes. Hi. My name is Ava, and I'm a relatively new member. But I wanted to follow up on some of the discussion here and ask, like, whether you have a consumer education component at all. To the extent you mentioned that there are lots of websites, and maybe sometimes that's the problem, because as a consumer, it's actually hard to find information on, like, what's the most effective way for me to go about trying to make a difference. So I was wondering if you'd do something on that front.
I'm wondering if I can call on Sam, because you would probably know better than I what we have. How's that? I try and get my allies in. All right, we're training a network. We're a team.
So, yeah, we have an action network. We have a website. We actually had a campaign maybe around the time you joined called Make the Switch, which was calculating how many light bulbs you might switch out and the climate effect that might have if you switch out all your light bulbs. So you're right, though. There's a lot of information out there. I think as high consumers of information, everyone here is very knowledgeable and into the issues here. So I think the best that we can do is educate ourselves as best we can. As Steve was mentioning, use your networks, get your networks organized, join EDF, get them to join EDF if you can. That'd be great. And, you know, we will continue to try to rally the troops and deliver the political force that the grassroots force to try to drive home change here in the United States and hopefully around the world.
And if you have suggestions for us about things that you'd like to see that we're not, we're all ears. You know, if there's something on the website, I mean, we do all kinds of things. My team put up, methane leaks in 15 urban cities. So you could look up, zoom in.
Leaks.
Right. I'm sorry. Good. Leak detection. Sorry. Thank you. I'm getting tired on that. Steve's going to abandon me. So we put up maps of where the leaks were in the cities and quantified them, and you could zoom in, and we gave you what you could do. Thanks, Steve. What you could do to call your public utility commission or utility, wherever the roadblock was. Sometimes it was utility, sometimes it was government. So, and we try and have campaigns like that. We've done work on air quality and a series of other things on toxics and what you can do and what you have to avoid. So we try and bring as much of that forward so that it's available to you. But if you have ideas of things that we should be doing, we could be doing that'd be useful, we'd love to hear. The question in the back there, right next to you, Sam.
Hi, Waleed Pateri. Could you talk about, you mentioned like 1% of all car sales are electric. So let's talk about 25 years from now when that number maybe is the majority of cars sold, optimistically. What is the solution for this massive global inventory that will exist of all of these gas-burning cars that will be emitting emissions for decades because of the duration that cars last?
Great question in terms of, you know, how do we turn over the stock faster? Because a lot of the cars, you know, we might sell them here in the U.S. and think there's nothing left and they get shipped to somewhere else where they get used. There are a couple different things, but it's a great problem that we have to figure out a solution for. So one is that California at one point had a cash for clunkers program where they took some of the income from various programs and they basically bought the dirty cars off the road. So that you get it off. So that's one thing that could be done. Another thing is depending on your tax structures, you might create it so it's less economical to have that old car to get something that's still not new, but is of a new generation, whether it be electric or something that's super high But I'm trying to look among my colleagues if someone else – I don't work in that specific area, so I'm just seeing if any one of my colleagues has others. But absolutely, you have to do that. Now, the good news with cars is on average, if we're 25 years in your future, as you say, a lot of the cars we have today, most of them will be gone. And so the question is, obviously, if you go to Cuba, some of the cars that are a lot older on average than 25 years. But we need a concrete program. So one of the things that we've been working on right now is things like autonomous vehicles. And how do we make sure that as we move in the direction of autonomous vehicles, we get a good positive program that actually benefits the environment and society? Because that's not inevitable. Because there could be a model where you get autonomous vehicles that each of us buys one, and it's just driving around doing our shopping, and if you're not there, it just goes off, right? You don't park it. It just goes off somewhere, and you call it back, and it comes back. Well, that would be terrible. We'd have more vehicles, as opposed to you don't actually have the car. You just call up a car. It shows up. It takes you where you want to go, and then there are fewer cars. There's less congestion, and there's much more rapid turnover of the stock because it's constantly moving. It makes its money back in only a few years, and it gets replaced. So I think one of the key is making sure that the vision of the future doesn't see much utility in those old vehicles because you don't need to, because you have new, efficient vehicles that make your life better and cost-effectively, that there isn't a cost incentive. But you're absolutely right. You have to set something in place to avoid exporting or a segment of the population picking up that cheaper. But it has to be cost effectively. You can't be just about raising the price overall. Yeah. Just one second. There's a mic coming.
Oh, thank you. My name is Phil Moss. I was a lawyer for EDF back in the 1970s, so...
Appreciate
your
service.
You guys have grown quite a bit.
You've grown.
Yeah. You've come a long way, baby. But the question I have, I run into the argument both on the internet and talking with people that climate change remediation is kind of a backdoor or Trojan horse approach to implement socialism. And I know it's not true. But I think maybe a more forceful refutation of that might be in order. I just see that argument so often.
Well, I think, you know, and again, we're getting way away from, as the chief scientist, the things that that I do and know well. But, you know, I think the key is certainly EDF has been very markets focused for a long time and saying that the markets can help. And we're talking about methane and the companies. That's a market base. They're recognizing a market advantage to cleaning up their act. So I think what we just have to do is keep pushing these ideas that, for example, the energy stuff that Steve talked about, is that they don't require anything other than putting a set of guardrails on what you do and let the market take off, right? Say, okay, you can't pollute, but we're not telling you which technology. We're just saying here are the characteristics. We just have to, again, that's where your networks come in, so that those who think that, and we've had those conversations with many people, some of it you won't change because they just don't want to accept that maybe we need those guardrails, all right, that a pure market isn't going to get us to the solution. Doesn't mean the market, but we have to say you need to have reduced emissions or zero emissions. We're not telling you what the solution is. Let's figure it out, but let the market drive the price down. So I would say part of it is really us collectively working to convince people that this isn't black and white. The cost doesn't have to be sky high. It doesn't require draconian central planning, that there are lots of solutions that don't require that, and let's get on with the work, and that you don't have to agree on a philosophy. We can debate that politically because there are many options, and let the process figure out what that option. It is not automatic. There's nothing that says it had. Could you do it with a central? Sure, probably you could. Can you do it with a market with guardrails? Yes. So that's not the issue. I mean, we have to go through in the U.S. a political process to figure out what the right mechanisms are, and we're agnostic on that mechanism. As long as it gets us there, we think a price on carbon is a critical part of doing that, but we don't say it has to be this way. It doesn't have to be cap and trade. It doesn't have to be a tax. There are multiple ways you could do it. Question all the way in the back.
Hi, Cindy Dupree. Just wanted to comment on your earlier observation. I work in engineering and in IT, And in fact, my husband and I were in a Tesla dealership just last night. But often we'll talk about technology like AI, artificial electronic cars, as solving the problem. But what we're seeing is that we're more plugged in than ever. And when you plug in, that requires electricity, energy. So how do we actually start to change the behaviors and increase awareness? Because someone else mentioned population. Population growth is one thing, but our behaviors being more and more energy dependent, we can change a light bulb, but that doesn't mean we're unplugging our laptops all night long as they're charging. So how do we start to create some of that awareness and consciousness?
So great question. But again, energy, depending on where you get the energy, may not be the problem. I mean, sure, if you use less energy, you've got a higher probability. But we find that you can use less energy, right? So the net energy is what you care about. So the fact that your computer today compared to, I'm old enough, I know when I, my first K-Pro, so those of you who are old enough, you know, my first K-Pro used more energy than my computer does now. And it did, you know, I don't know what minuscule percentage of what it can do. So the energy usage has actually gone down. Same thing with your automobile. If plugging it in is not inherently a bad thing, it's a good thing. It depends on where you're getting electricity from. Because the energy, we're not trying to squeeze all the energy, we're trying to squeeze all the carbon. So one of the things that I like to say is it's not about 100% renewable, it's not about getting rid of fossil fuels, it's about decarbonization and doing it equitably and doing it so reliable and doing it quickly. And if we meet those characteristics, maybe having your computer plugged in is just not a big deal. If you're getting it from a coal-fired power plant, you bet. And the nice part about the light bulbs is you increase the quality of your environment with using a lot less energy. We ran a program in Providence, Rhode Island, where we provided, this was something I developed when I was at Brown University with the students. And we said, we're doing all these great things at Brown to reduce our energy use and reduce our carbon footprint, but we're not doing it in the community. So we started a program to provide free energy efficient light bulbs to any low income household, self-identified. We didn't, no criteria. You come in, you want them, we'll give them. And we relamped 5,000 households in Providence, and 20% of the sockets were empty because people couldn't afford. We filled 100% and their energy usage went down by close to $3 million. And they spent less money, had higher quality light. And it's the same in India. I've been in villages where we've worked on methane emissions from rice. And if we can take that light bulb and give them 4 light bulbs or 5 light bulbs or 6 light bulbs for the same energy, their quality of life goes up and their footprint stays constant. So I think that we have to think about what are the net utility we provide, and I think we can do a lot more with a lot less. But the key thing is make sure we get the carbon out of it, and we know how to do that now, which is the really exciting news. Question over here.
Thank you. Peter Shutley. How effective, efficient have some of the carbon tax regimes worked? How much have they succeeded, the exchanges, to put a price on carbon and reduce carbon use?
I'm going to look around, and I may tell you we have to get back to you on that, because I'm not we have people who work on that extensively, and I'm fearful of giving you an answer because I'm not sure I'm going to give you an informed answer. And so what we will ask is there will be cards out there. If you can write your question down, I promise you we'll get back to you. But some of the LG left. I was looking for some of the folks who work more of that, and I'm just far enough away that I don't want to give you an uninformed answer. So, maybe one or two last questions.
Larry Miller, my question is nuclear.
All right, nuclear. I should have had LG for that too. He worked at the Department of Energy for a long time. So we do not take as an organization a position on nuclear per se, but we do believe you have to solve some of the inherent problems in nuclear. So we have a waste problem, clearly. We have to make sure we do it safely. Now, with that said, we have supported legislation that's passed in Illinois and New Jersey that provides some subsidy to nuclear, existing nuclear. And part of the reason for that, an important part of the, and as part of those bills, we also pushed hard and we led the effort to make sure that they also increased renewables expenditure on the state so that they were getting more renewables while they protect. And part of that is that the existing nuclear produces 20% of the electricity roughly in the United States. And it's essentially, it's maybe not zero, but it's darn close to zero carbon. And I got into, some of you may know the name Amory Lovins, who Soft Energy Pass, who was really the pioneer in pushing back against nuclear in the 60s. Sorry about that. I should have turned my phone off. I made the mistake of speakers number one there. Sorry about that. And he was pushing on why are we these bills in Illinois and why were we supporting subsidies? And I wrote him back a very simple answer, which is the illustration is Vermont Yankee. They shut down Vermont Yankee in New England, and they did work hard to come up with a backfill so that that was met with renewables, fill that hole. And I said, well, isn't that success? No, that's not. That's still failure. You started with a zero energy. You built a lot of renewables, and your carbon emissions look just like they did the day you started that whole effort. It's not on top of. We need, in this pathway, if we care about carbon, we need as much as is safe and appropriate, so I'm not saying all nuclear, to keep that existing nuclear. Now, it'll time out because of the licenses. It goes off a cliff in terms of how much, about 2035. We need as much of that power to keep the carbon down while we maximize the rate of building renewables. And then the question is, do we build any more? Do we extend the life? That's a very open question. We're in the middle of modeling and figuring out, you know, I don't know the answer there. I have my personal beliefs on what it's likely to be. It's very expensive. I think, as we talked about, there are many more options now with carbon capture and sequestration, with some bioenergy. There are a couple of different ways of getting to low to zero carbon emissions. But we have to be careful if we start banning individual things, because there's a big community against wind. I have a place in the mountains in New Hampshire, and we had some large wind projects go up, and now effectively you can't build wind in New Hampshire because people are opposing it on the wind the ridge tops. I do live in Rhode Island, where the first offshore wind windmills are off Block Island, where I spend time as well. But if we have to make sure that we keep, in that sense, right, all the options on the table to get to decarbonization. The moment we start crossing them out, that path gets harder and more expensive. So with that, maybe I want to thank you. I realize it was a complicated night. We'll hope that she was all right. Thank you so much for your support. Thank you very much for coming. And I will, as I said to the gentleman before, if you have a question that you weren't able to ask, we have cards. We promise to get back to you. Please put your question down, and we'll get back to you. Again, thanks so much for your support, and great having you here tonight.